QSO Today, episode 495, Charles Wilmont, M0OXO. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. I want to thank the new and recurring monthly listener sponsors for their generous support of QSO Today. That includes Joey Smith, N4VFA, Mark Farrell, VK6OP, J. Gordon Betty Jr., W2TTT, Grayson Evans, KJ7UM, Adrian Lambert, M5ADL, and Robert Swain, W5APO. I want to thank Dominic Tusa, K5EF, for his generous donation of $200. Dominic has become the number one financial contributor to QSO Today, and I want to thank him and all of the contributors to QSO Today, especially as we get close to episode 500, where I'm working for a different but valuable QSO Today project, working towards episodes 1,000. There were anonymous donations as well, and I want to thank them for their donations. All of the sponsorships and donations pay for services and server hosting, legal fees to protect the QSO Today brand, I'm even being attacked by the Chinese now, and product and services that we use to create and post the podcast and QSO Today Academy videos. Only 6% of our regular listeners support QSO Today in any way. Please show your support at any level today. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio? Do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. There is a banner in the show notes page and menu item at the top of the QSOtoday.com website called Talk Groups that are the All-Star and DMR groups in Israel, where I hang out with my friends both in Israel and abroad to talk about what's going on and what we're doing. If you'd like to join us, please click on the banner or menu item for more information. Keep in mind that we are 10 hours ahead of California and 7 hours ahead of New York. Charles Wilmont, M0OXO, operates a private, self-funded QSL management bureau, where he sorts and distributes both physical and electronic QSL cards for distribution around the world for the best-known de-expeditions, including 3YOK Beauvais and Peter 1 Islands, as well as IOTA or Islands on the Air. We touch on Charles' ham radio beginnings and his private career as a police officer in Sheffield, United Kingdom, made famous by the movie The Full Monty. M0OXO is my QSO today. M0OXO, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Charles?
Hello, Eric, 4Z1UG. This is Charles, M0OXO. Look down in Barnsley in South Yorkshire in good old England.
And you're going to have to give us a little bit more explanation of where that is exactly.
Well, I guess if you look at a map on the main island of the UK, right in the middle of it, you'll find the town of Barnsley. And it's situated north of Sheffield and south of Leeds, right in the middle.
And for the American listeners, Charles and I were just saying that Sheffield is the home of the movie The Full Monty, and you're north of Sheffield. And that's coal mining country, right?
That's right, yeah, the old coal mines. Not too many left of them these days, unfortunately, but, yeah, feelings are still very strong, and all the ex-miners, of course, still live here. Most of them are still doing other jobs.
Can you share the story behind your first encounter with amateur radio, and what inspired you to obtain your license, M0OXO?
Yeah, returning to you, Eric. Well, I guess the interest was sparked due to my occupation, well, my former occupation as a police officer. I worked for 20-odd years doing the usual things, working on major cases, crimes, murders, that sort of thing. And then near the end of the time, I started to work in the force control room as a radio operator. And it was very good, very enjoyable, quite enjoyed that until I retired. And then I actually retired early due to a back injury that I suffered at work. And I took a portable radio with me while I was laid up in bed having the operation, and I discovered the amateur bands. And of course, I knew the police had different communication types, but I was laid up in bed having a back operation, and I discovered the handbands with a little handheld radio.
In terms of being a police officer, you went through being a patrolman all the way through being a detective.
No, I worked on the front line most of the time, working predominantly on my own or with another guy, just in what we would call the normal beat cars, the little patrol cars, dealing with everything from domestics to more serious things.
To differentiate yourself, perhaps, from, say, American policemen, it sounded to me like you also did some investigation. Was that part of what a patrolman also does?
Yeah, of course, you did investigation into the normal crimes in the local areas. And I spent several years working on a group with about five or six other guys, and we got sent to all the major crimes, the murders, the kidnappings, all that sort of thing. So we did investigation that way. So quite enjoyable and quite a diverse career, really.
And then you moved into the dispatch. I'm assuming that by the time you got to dispatch, things were kind of automated. There was a fair amount of like 911, or how does someone call an emergency in England?
That's what they would have done. Normally, we have 999, of course, not 111. That would go to a central control room, which would send the inquiry out to the local areas. And round about as I was finishing, I would say we'd pretty much just got into the automated era where you were getting apps on the screen rather than using a dial-up telephone. So still quite a long time ago, you know, 30 years ago.
It was a long time ago, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
When you're in the hospital and you're listening to a portable radio, what kind of portable radio? A shortwave radio?
It was actually an airband scanner that had the facility to go down onto the emergency channels. And I started off really listening to the helicopter rescue services, and that's how I picked up the handbands. I just sort of scrolled out of their frequency areas, and I dropped on some guys locally having a chat.
And how did you then take that next step? Did you find a radio club, or did you know any amateur radio operators?
I didn't know any amateur radio operators at all, other than the ones I did locally on the handheld radio. My wife asked me to get a hobby after I finished work. I joined the local radio club across in Wakefield, which is in West Yorkshire, just south of Leeds, and spent quite a bit of time there going through the examinations.
Did you have any mentors or Elmers from the radio club that decided to take you under their wing and kind of give you some tutelage?
No, not really. No, there were two or three guys. One was Silent Key Now, John, G3LZQ, and another local guy I spent a lot of years with, John, G4RCG, and they've helped me along the way. And this is where we've got to today. So very grateful for their help. And of course, they had decent stations by then, and radio clubs usually had a good station where by the people like me just joining the hobby may not have had a decent antenna or a decent radio. So you would join the radio club to get that experience. And it was invaluable, yeah, really good.
And when you get a license in the UK, is there like a period of time where you kind of like have training wheels, meaning that you actually need to do some operating time with other amateurs in order to be able to, say, upgrade your license?
Yeah, you can start off. We've got three license grades, foundation, intermediate and full. Or advanced as it is now, and you would have had limitations when I started. You could only transmit with 10 watts, and then you'd have to go through certain building components. Then you get onto the intermediate level, which was a bit more advanced, where you'd be talking to people, speaking to locals, doing more work, and then, of course, the advanced, which was the full license, which took a lot more work, mainly academic, I think, I would say, yeah.
And what level are you at?
I'm at the advanced level. I got the advanced level after about three or four years, I think, something like that, yeah.
So do you think your wife was right in terms of you getting a hobby?
She was right at the time, but uh-huh. If you brought her in now, she'd say that it's taken over your life and I wish you'd stop.
Well, it seems to me that if she comes down into your basement, you send me some pictures beforehand of some of the things that are happening in your basement. And it seems to me that amateur radio pretty much dominates at least that corner of the basement.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's a full-time job, as it is for many people, I guess. I spend 6-8 hours a day now on, radio-related work, which obviously will come until later, but I don't get as much operating time as I used to do.
What aspect of amateur radio do you find the most fulfilling, and how has it impacted your life both personally and professionally?
I enjoy CW and some of the data modes. I don't particularly like SSB these days, but of course, I moved into the QSL sort of management some years ago now, and that's really all I do these days. A little bit of operating. I still chase the XCC. I still chase IOTA, but mainly I'm doing QSL work at the moment.
I do want to talk about QSL work, but let's talk a little bit about your amateur radio station. What is the current rig at your place?
At the moment, I've got the Kenwood TS990. I've had that for quite some years now. It's a lovely transceiver, and I've no intention of getting rid of that at the moment. Power amplifier is an Alpha 87A, and I've got a backup Expert 1.3 FKA. Only a small plot of land here, small house, so the only antenna I've got is a six-band hex beam up at about 30 feet, 15, 16 meters or so.
And you like the hex beam?
Yeah, it works very well for me. I think in the hobby, you're always wanting more, you're always wanting better. But from my point of view, once you accept what you can actually get inside your property, you know, you just carry on with that, I think, really. Once you accept it, then everything's good. You're not wanting and wanting and hoping. So, yeah, I'm very happy with it. It does all I need.
I think I'm probably in a very similar situation to you, is I've got kind of a narrow lot connected to a building next door. They call these cottages, in other places they might be called townhouses. And so therefore, an inverted V or a hex beam sounds like the right thing, because it wouldn't quite hang over the neighbor's yard.
Some years ago, I had a two-element stepper with the 3040 kit on, and that covered three gardens. So yeah, it was time to downsize a bit and get the hex beam.
We were covering your neighbor's gardens as well?
Yeah. If obviously, depending which way the neighbors turned, yeah. But they're good neighbors. We've got on with them for a lot of years, so they're quite happy. But one or two people complained about the hex beam years ago, but these days they tend to just accept it as it is.
Do you share your amateur radio hobby with any of the neighbors or any of the neighbors' kids?
No, not at all. My son, who's now in his 30s, he took his foundation license, maybe 20, 22 years ago. And he did a little bit of operating, but of course, as he got older, he's lost the interest and he's doing other things now. So no, nobody at all, just me at the moment.
Now, you mentioned that you're involved with IOTA, that's Islands on the Air, and you do that as a chaser. First of all, maybe you could talk a little bit about Islands on the Air and what kind of pursuit that is from the UK. And also, what does that mean that you're a chaser?
Well, if you're chasing IOTA, when I first started, basically collecting islands, it would be a bit too lengthy to go into the rules and what actually classes as an IOTA or an island for IOTA, Islands on the Air program. But basically, just listening to people that's putting the station on the air from different islands, collecting each one, which has a separate group or a separate number, and just trying to rack the totals up and work as many as you can. It's similar, same as the poultry in America, which is taking off now, parks on the air. Every park or sort of area has a certain reference number, and it's basically just a case of ticking them off in a book is the easiest way to explain it.
It's funny, islands on the air are actually mountaintops underwater, like soda above ground. It's soda below the water.
Yeah, I progressed a little. I'm now a member of the IOTA management team, so I'm the awards manager for the Islands on the Air program.
And what kind of responsibility is that?
It can get quite busy. I think post-COVID, things really took a downward turn. There were no activity. Nobody were going to the islands, obviously. But it's starting to build back up now, and it's very busy. Around about January time, end of January, is what we call the annual updates, where everybody sends their yearly totals in, which get published. So January can be very busy with award certificates, plaques, and, other sort of awards and media.
It seems to me that all the de-expeditions seem to go out to islands as well. So you get some Islands on the Air credit working de-expeditions as well.
Right, yeah. And it's always, if it's a new island or it's a new DXC, it's always nice to get them both. It doesn't always work that way, but it's very rewarding.
Now, Can you discuss, perhaps, do you have any memorable contacts or QSOs, and what made that stand out for you?
Well, the only one that still stands out is 3 Yankee Zero X-Ray, which was Peter the First Island back in, might have been 2003, 2004, I'm guessing. And I worked that with a genuine 10 watts from the radio club station. They had a decent antenna. We had a 4-element step IR at a very good location, but it was a true 10 watts, as the license at the time allowed me to use.
And was that a single sideband conversation?
It was, yeah.
The expeditions are a significant part of amateur radio, and it appears that you support many of these de-expeditions through your QSL card management. Can you talk a little bit about how you started your QSL bureau and how it supports de-expeditions?
Yeah, it's a big subject, Eric, so I'll just try and...
Talking about it is a big subject.
Yeah, well, I started basically, I think, like many do, QSL manager for your local radio club, and that progressed over a number of years. And then I sort of moved up and got the opportunity to work with one or two people that were doing larger de-expeditions and providing the QSL support for them.
Can we go back to if you're a QSL manager, because it's possible that I've got listeners maybe who are newer to ham radio and may not actually understand what the job of a QSL manager is.
Sure, yeah. Well, as we spoke about with the IOTA and DXCC, I suppose the reason for people to go to the islands is to give away the credit to the people that chase them, either for DXCC or for IOTA or many other things now that's coming aboard. And the QSL manager would receive the log from the team at some point. Back in the day, it might have been a paper log. Now, of course, they're all computerized. And then when people wanted it confirming, they would contact the QSL manager, explain to them that they'd had a QSO or multiple QSOs, and the QSL manager would provide the confirmation by way of a QSL card back then. But, of course, now we've got several more ways of acceptable confirmations.
So essentially the QSL manager becomes the manager for that de-expedition. So he's the contact point for confirming the QSO. And he confirms that by sending out QSL cards. I mean, how do they confirm it? They send their log in and then you confirm it against the two logs. You're looking at the de-expedition log and you're looking at the contactees log?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, you look at the de-expedition log, the time, dates, and whatever he's submitted, and you look into the log, try to confirm it, which is usually a simple process. It's either in the log or it's not in the log, and then you confirm it by way of this printed QSL card.
And I'm assuming that if you're a de-expedition, then you're looking to offload that responsibility because you have other responsibilities like getting to the island and getting set up and stuff. So how did you get your first? Was it through the DX Club or your radio club that allowed you to get your first de-expedition to be the QSL manager?
I'm trying to think which the first one was, but I don't remember, Eric. But what I do remember is back in the early days when the 5-star DX team went to T32C, they did T32C. And back then, there was not much electronic matching or QSL common information, so it were QSL cards. And we had 10 or 12 QSL managers working on that de-expedition alone. You'd receive a big box or a big bag of letters sent by Neville Cheadle, G3NUG, who's now Silent Key. He would send the cards out to us. We'd open the box, and then we would process them. But there were at least, I'm sure it were 10 or 12 of us. So back then it were a big job, whereas now as times changed, 100,000, 120,000 QSO de-expedition can quite easily be dealt with just by one person.
In those days, that process was as if I worked a de-expedition, I would fill out one of my QSL cards and I would send it to the QSL manager. He would take the card, he would look at it, and he would compare it to the log and count it as a contact.
That's correct, yeah. And then it would enter it into the electronic log, which was still in its basic form back then. And then at some point, he would print all these out either on labels or direct to the card itself. And he would send the card back to you, and then you've got your confirmation.
He would send the de-expeditions card back.
Yes, that's correct.
And the QSL manager would keep the card from the person that made the inquiry.
Well, yeah.
But I mean, the group, the law, you know.
We would keep it for a period of time, but these days most of the expeditions are not interested in the card, so they get recycled nowadays.
With everything being electronics, are there still people that are making and sending cards?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. People are always asking, do you think the QSL card business is dying or declining? There's still a huge demand for QSL cards, without a doubt. But the interest in electronic matching by Logbooker World has gone up massively. So most people are having both Logbooker World credit, which is done electronically, and then QSL cards, the hard copy paper card. So it's still very, very busy, and it's an option that's certainly not going to die out anytime soon.
If you were recommending then an electronic service, you just did Logbook of the World seems to be the most popular.
Yeah, there's Logbook of the World. Yeah, that's the most popular. You've got other options where you can match them electronically, but they're not always valid for the awards by the ARRL. So such as EQSL, QRZ.com, they have their own logbook now. And a lot of these aren't. They're not valid for the confirmation from the ARRL LOTW. Yeah, so generally I just offer a direct QSL card by post, Logbook of the World, and that's pretty much it. We can use the bureau service, but that's another topic to discuss. But we do send them by the bureau as well, which takes a long time.
If you're submitting your log electronically, although it seems to me that if I'm working a de-expedition, I may only have, if I'm lucky, 4 or 5 QSOs that I might send in. Is there a format or a online form that could also be used by somebody to you directly that actually would allow that to be confirmed?
Yeah, I have a system. It's called the OQRS, Online QSL Request System. And people can just go to that and they can look on the site. They'll look for the station that I'm managing, I think there's around about 850 call signs now. And they'll select it from a list, and then they'll input their data into it, which comes to me. If it's a direct card they want, they pay a small fee, $3, and I send the card out to them. It's very fast, very efficient. But we still do accept them through the door. The old postal service, they still come that way, but doing it via OQRS is definitely the best way for us.
Now, you sent me a picture of a big shelf system that's in your basement, I'm assuming. That looks like you're also a QSL bureau. I've been doing this for 50 years, but I don't think I've ever used a QSL bureau. Can you tell me how a QSL bureau works, and does it avoid the postal system in some way?
The IARU have a bureau in most countries. So it's generally run by volunteers, I would suggest. And they would get all the cards from around the world into, for example, Norway. And the Norwegian Bureau would then send them out to all the Norwegian hams, having filtered them through their call signs. The person would then reply to the card, send it back to the Norwegian Bureau, who would distribute them again. But it would take a long time to get to all the different IAR bureaus, going through the slow mail system that we had back then.
And now this break. The QSO Today project that includes this podcast and the QSO Today Academy is now listener-sponsored. There are no commercial sponsors to influence the content and opinions expressed on QSO Today, including my blog posts. Disclaimer, we did not have a problem with sponsor influence when we did have commercial sponsors. The world is different now. I believe that commercial sponsorship, where you watch and listen to TV, radio, YouTube, Facebook, and X for free, does give sponsors complete control over all that you see and hear. The largest networks are now dominated by international corporations who decide in their boardrooms what we hear, know about, how we vote, and what we buy. Commercial sponsorship models for podcasts don't work, maybe for good reasons. At QSO Today, we are back to blogging and podcasting for the free expression of ideas, discussion, and the dissemination of content without commercial sponsorship. It takes everyone's ideas and approaches in our discussions to formulate our own way with the best information available. This has always been the best formula for success, even in ham radio. So QSO Today is now value for value, following the model created by another ham, Adam Curry, K5AAC, inventor of podcasting and the value for value business model. I create valuable amateur radio content that you consume. In return, you find it valuable, then you reward the podcast with your sponsorships, donations, transcription sponsorships, and using the QSO Today Amazon link. Your supporting the podcast in this way keeps QSO Today podcast coming to you every week since July of 2014, now approaching 500 episodes. In addition, we have over 500 educational ham radio videos from previous QSO Today virtual ham expos that we also publish to allow every ham to benefit from these excellent presentations. However, all of this content has to be produced, edited, curated, and hosted on commercial platforms by me and my team to keep it easily accessible and available to you. Links and banners on the show notes pages allow you to show your support of the QSO Today project. Please support QSO Today with your sponsorships, donations, and using our Amazon links. And now back to our QSO Today. The question I have about the QSL Bureau, it seems to me that if QSL cards come in, say, to a national bureau, and then they get sorted off, do they get sorted off to radio clubs in various geographical areas, and then they also have, or it may be in the way it used to work in the olden days, that they would also have their own QSL bureau to kind of divvy up the cards for their members and people in the area?
Yeah, that's right, Eric. That's exactly what happens, and it's a really slow system. They would go back to their national societies, such as the RSGB, and they would distribute them around the world to the IARU bureaus. But this was a very, very slow process, sometimes 2-3 years. So when we set our process up, we decided that we'd work as a separate sort of bureau, and that's what the pigeonholes are for here. We put the cards in each individual box for the country which it's going to. If the bureau is open, some of the bureaus have closed, and we send the packages off maybe twice a year if we can manage that.
Are you a private bureau, and so therefore you are, in terms of funding to pay for postage and all those things, is that done by donation?
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, it's self-funded. The bureau posting is self-funded. We try to do it from donations that come in, but we don't get that many. And last year, for example, the full postage bill was £22,500 we paid. And that was just March 23 to March 24, just over £22,000. So it's very expensive, and yeah, donations help, but they're not always forthcoming.
Are people that maybe run their cards through or are requesting confirmations from the expedition, would they be compelled to pay a fee? Or again, it's all donation based and you hope that it's worth a few bucks to them to get the confirmation?
Yeah, the de-expeditions, we pay for it all, basically, but we have a contract with Royal Mail where we can send our mail a little cheaper than normal. The more we send, the cheaper it is. So the money we make of sending the mail, we plow back into the system, which funds the Bureau. But these days, the expedition teams, when they set up the OQRS systems for them, it uses their PayPal address, their bank account, and they set all the fees. So everything bypasses the QSL manager. It goes straight into their account, and all we do is deal with the card request itself.
Now, personally, when you operate, do you have your own QSL card? Do you find that you still like them?
Yeah, I love to collect cards, especially from the day expeditions, the special cards they produce. I have my own, but as I say, there's not much demand for mine. We're just a lowly G station, so not many people want our cards these days.
Given your experience for the last almost 27 years, I think, you've been a ham?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
Given your experience, how do you see the role of technology influencing the future of amateur radio, especially with the rise of, say, digital modes and software-defined radio? Is that something you think about or are you excited about?
No, I wouldn't say I'm excited about it. The technology is great, but I'm old school. I prefer the stuff as it is, or it has been over the last few years. We've got things now where they're sending, remote stations onto islands or rare islands that have not been activated for many years, even if before, and they're using, remote access to them. So this is something that we'll look at closely, and not everybody's on the same page with it. Some don't like it, some do like it. If you've got 339 DXCCs and you need the last one, the 340th, and they send a rib to an island, you might not agree with it, but then you've got to ask yourself, do you want to work it? That's the thing, Eric.
So when you say a rib to an island, I think that's the idea that they'll go to a far-out island that probably is practically uninhabitable, and so they'll put a remotely controlled station on the island and then work from the boat.
That's absolutely spot on, yeah. So you're not speaking to the operator at the other end. It's just a remote QSO with that station. And the technology is great. I think for some aspects, the ARRL, they're on board with it, great. But from the IOTA, as one group of people, they're not into the remote access. It don't fit into their rules at all. So remote access for the moment with IOTA, Islands on the Air, they're not available to claim the credit with those.
So you could have someone like a Coast Guard or something like that deliver a package to a rare island, and the operators could remain stateside or in their home QTHs and work through that rib in order to provide the contacts. Am I off base there, or am I thinking that the operators are actually on the nice warm boat that happens to be floating around the island and operating?
Yeah, well, yeah, you could say that, and that's how it does work. And I wouldn't like to knock them because, you know, everybody's got their own views, and they're doing a good job for the people that want to do it like that. But for the old school radio hams, maybe they're not in touch with it. I know for the guys like in the States, they have some people that have no other way to operate other than operating through a remote station. So it's good for them, I've got to admit, but it's just not for me.
I'm not making a judgment. The only judgment I make, I think, with remote operation, it used to be under the rules in the United States anyway, that if you operate a remote station, you would use your call sign through something W7ABC remote, so that at least if you were listening to that person calling, you knew they were actually operating a remote station. But I can operate a remote station from here in Israel using my American call sign, and just use my American call sign coming out of that remote station in North America, and people would think that I'm in California, even though I could be operating a remote station in Maine, for example. I'm just saying it's gotten a little bit confusing. So if you're listening to somebody talking on a remote station, again, I think remote stations are great, but you don't know that you're talking to a person from a remote station.
That's absolutely correct. But again, I mean, if you're going into, we don't really want to delve into the licensing conditions, but I mean, with North American stations, you can work a K86, believing it's in Hawaii, but it's actually in Maine or somewhere, I don't know. Not everything's helpful in the hobby, but yeah, as it goes, you know, technology's moving on. We've got to grasp it, and I don't knock anybody that wants to do it. It just doesn't suit me at the moment.
Do you have a ham radio workbench? Do you like to work on anything technical?
Absolutely not, no.
You'd like to do what you do, and you do it well when you do it.
Yeah, I've never been interested in components, soldering, and all the, you know, that sort of thing. And I think the old, what we call them, the G3s, that's how they were brought up. But now in modern times, we do it for the license and as upgrade. But no, it's not for me. It never has been, Eric.
What kind of role do you play in your amateur radio club?
We don't have a club at the moment. A lot of the clubs locally have dissolved. I think during COVID, it was a big problem to pay bill when there were no meetings. And certainly my local radio club, that's one that went down the hole very recently. We do have them locally, but to be fair, at the moment, I ain't got time for radio clubs. I'm spending too much time doing what I'm doing as it is, and spending any more time might go against the grain with the XYL.
Just the management of QSLs for de-expeditions is a full-time job. What's the season for that? Meaning that once they arrive on the island, the season gets started and you're busy until could be a year after the de-expedition?
Yeah, I think around about September, October last year, there were the Swains de-expedition, Whiskey 8 Sierra, Papa Romeo 0 Tango, which was Trinidad and Martin Vaz Islands, and then a couple of guys went down to Yemen, and they all dropped at the same time in October. And I'm still working quite heavily on all three of them now at the beginning of March. Hopefully it'll fizzle out over the next 4 weeks, but I'm sort of booked. I've got things booked in now right up to June, July next year. So.
And you still have time to operate, kind of?
Kind of, yeah. Not very often. My wife recently retired, and I thought, well, I could do with a bit of help with the QSL work. So I set her off sticking address labels on envelopes. She did 80 envelopes, and she lost the will to live. How do you do this? He said, I've no idea. All I want to do is hang myself. So I'm back on my own, working alone again.
There are machines that do that stuff. I bet you could probably find surplus an envelope addressing machine that you run all the envelopes through and it just addresses them for you.
Well, the system that we have, the as we keep calling it, the OPRS system, does that. It prints, when people request a card, it prints the label for the QSOs they've had, and it also prints their address label. Both come off the printer at the same time, so all you've got to do is manage the envelope up with a card. So, providing you get it right and you don't muck up, then everything's good. But if you do mess up, you're talking 2 or 3 days extra work.
If you met somebody who's just getting started in amateur radio, or you meet a ham that is coming back into amateur radio after a long hiatus, what advice would you give them to find success in ham radio?
Well, that's a tough one. I honestly don't know. I think if you're coming back after a period of time, you would find it very, very difficult. I don't really know how to answer that one, Eric. I'm sorry.
It sounds to me like you're kind of, maybe by choice, put yourself into a silo of activity, which is this QSL Bureau.
Yeah, that's right. I have, yeah. Mentioned it a few days ago. I created the role for myself, and this is where we are. You're stuck with it, and I think you're stuck with it for life. It's not something... You can't turn around to 850 guys and say, sorry, by the way, I've decided not to do this anymore. You're going to find somebody else. It doesn't work like that. Once you take this sort of job on, you know, you're there for life.
Well, do you think that it's the kind of job that you could hire a disciple or an apprentice to actually do this for you, or do this with you to the point of passing it on to someone else?
You could do, yeah. I would say a few years ago you could have done that. You can ask people to do certain things. But now the system we have, it's so automated to one person that it makes it difficult to actually use a second person. You know, you've got the labels coming off at the same time. Like you say, labels as the address labels, both coming off the printer at the same time. You can't like hand a few sheets to somebody else to do, or they'd all be in the wrong order. So it's sort of tailored for one person to deal with it, really.
Do you aspire to go on any de-expeditions yourself?
No, not really. It's not really interesting me. I've done a few domestic ones, local ones, but maybe somewhere up north, up in Greenland or Svalbard, something like that. But the hot countries have no interest at all now.
Do you have the ability to take the XYL on vacation?
Not really, no. We go away quite a lot. But Debbie, she has multiple sclerosis, so traveling and mobility are not very good. And she certainly couldn't be doing anything more than a couple hour flight anyway. So we're pretty up that way, yeah.
You're not headed off to Australia or South Africa or anything like that anytime soon?
No, she can't travel. She can barely walk at the moment, so she'd be in a wheelchair, and it's just not the thing to do at the moment for us.
And now this mid-show break. Every 2 weeks, I listen to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast with George, KJ6VU, Vince, VE6LK, Mark, N6MTS, Thomas, K4SWL, Michael, VA3MW, and Rod, VA3ON, and their guest on often topical and important projects in amateur radio. This discussion amongst the regulars and their guests remind me of the conversations that I used to listen to on 146.94 and 146.46 megahertz in Orange County, California, while working on my own workbench almost 50 years ago. It is amazing how much practical ham radio knowledge that we can absorb by listening to the Workbench podcast that starts to make sense when we start our own deep dive into our own projects. So join me by listening to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast now and as George and crew push beyond 200 episodes. You can get to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast by clicking on the banner in this week's show notes page. And now, back to our QSO. Charles, is there anything that I haven't touched on with you that you might want to talk about in ham radio?
The expeditions, yeah, really. Well, keep them coming. I think at the moment, I keep mentioning COVID, but it's been a long hill. It's taken its time to build back up, but I think we're really getting there now. And you've got to commend these DX teams, you know, for putting the effort in and getting to these rare places. We have a few coming up over the next few months. But these days, what I would touch on, Eric, is the difference between most people now will use Clublog, which is developed by a lovely guy in the UK, Michael, G7VJR. Who I know personally, and this Clublog also has an OQRS system. So there is a difference. Clublog is not OQRS. If you mention to people, can you go to OQRS and request a card? They automatically think of Clublog. Clublog is only a platform for hosting the QSL request system. Clublog is a tool for amateur radio, for sports radio, and it's absolutely fantastic what it does. But the OQRS is separate. It's just hosted on that. So many people like myself or Tim M0URX, we all have OQRS systems in our own, on our own PCs, up on the cloud, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But OQRS is not Clublog. Clublog just hosts an OQRS system. That's what I'm trying to get across.
So in other words, if somebody's following a specific de-expedition, they should go to that de-expedition's website. And I'm assuming that there's a link to the QSL bureau that's handling, or the QSL manager that's handling the de-expedition.
Yeah, there's a link to it and everything there. You get some guys in North America, and they'll send you an email. I've requested the card on OQRS. I can't see it anywhere. And what they've done, they've gone to Clublog. They've seen the log format, which is pretty much identical to ours, and they'll see that they're trying to request the card, but they can't do it there. They need to come to my OQRS system. And it's difficult getting across that there is a difference between Clublog and an OQRS system. Clublog just hosts an OQRS system, just exactly as M0XO hosts his own OQRS system. Two separate, completely separate things.
The people who are interested in getting credit for working de-expeditions should probably go to the de-expedition website and actually see what are the requirements to getting confirmation. And in the case where you're managing the QSL management for that de-expedition, then it would say that don't use Clublog. Here's the link to our system directly.
It would, absolutely. But Clublog's fabulous. I mean, most of the de-expedition teams, or a lot of them, even though they're requesting the card on my system, they do like to have the log on Clublog because it shows the leader tables and people can chase and people can say, oh, he's worked one more than me, I need to have another go at it. And Clublog is absolutely fantastic system. No two ways about it. But yeah, people go on the website, look what the link is, and you'll find exactly how to get your card.
Or I could give you the name of my Ukrainian programmer that could actually write the API between your system and the Clublog system, so that if someone submitted by Clublog, they could feed your system at the same time.
Yeah, well, there's always that. In the early days, we did work with Michael and Marios and tried to use Clublog, but Clublog is tailored to the DXer, and we wanted a system that gave more information tailored to a QSL manager, like how many cards you're sending, how much it's costing. So our system is different.
The workflow is different.
Yeah. And we need different things. It tells us how many duplicates are making, who's making the duplicates on a day expedition. Do we need to target a certain area? So we do have different information on both systems. So it's important to use and look at both.
What day expedition coming up do you think is probably the most, although you shouldn't have a favorite, like they're all like your kids, but do you have one that's coming up that you think is going to be the most interesting, maybe because of its difficulty of getting there or the rareness of the entity?
The higher up in the DXCC most wanted list is the way to go, really. Beauvais would have been one of the biggest, the one that they did last year or the year before. We've got Beauvais coming up again in January 25, and then January 26, all being well, Peter the First Island again down in Antarctica. And I would suggest that if plans go, you know, well, everything goes as it's supposed to do, Peter 1 will be the biggest one that I will have managed, I guess. Unless they change their mind and ask a different manager, of course. There's always that.
Well, is there competition amongst managers?
I don't know if it's competition, but there's loads of managers out there. And there's certainly some great managers in North America, and they've been at it for a lot of years. So big respect to everybody. No competition from me or from my colleague. We just want the request system to work fine, to be efficient, and to do a good job for the expedition, no matter who was the manager.
The fact that you do it, it sounds like a lot of work, frankly, but it sounds to me that it's something that you really enjoy doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. Yeah. I sit there every day and I'm sticking labels every morning, and Debbie will say to me, how the hell can you do this? Don't you ever get fed up? But I don't. I really enjoy it. It's great. But then again, back in the day, I used to enjoy ironing as well. So I guess I'm one of them sort of people.
The most important thing for someone who might be retired is to have a destination every day.
Well, I don't move far from the house. Yeah, I don't. I do a little live. I have a second hobby. I do a bit of photography. I like to go out and photograph birds. So that's a bit of relief. I try and get a day in every week if I can. But since November, when we've been busy, I've barely had a day off until recently. It's been so busy.
Would you say that you're a bird watcher? Could you identify all the birds that you see?
I'm a bird watcher. I can identify them, but I won't go as far as ticking them off in a book, I'm afraid. That's not for me. See them, and I like to take the photographs.
Do you recognize their sounds?
Yeah, quite a lot, yeah.
Does England have a wide variety of birds?
Yeah, we do quite well, yeah. And we get quite a lot of rare and migrant birds from the States and from the continent and up north, depending on the season, depending on the wind. So we do very well over here for birds, yeah.
We get them too. We get over 1 billion birds fly over Israel every year. That's why we tell people that's why we wear hats.
Well, yeah. Well, you could go to one of the UK seaside places and you definitely need a hat, but they're all pigeons.
Recently, we have green parrots in the park, thousands of green parrots.
Yeah, we get them across here. We have the ringneck parakeets down in London. And in fact, we've got them locally, actually, up here around about, you know, 3 or 4 miles away. So they're spreading around the country quite a lot. But they're a noisy bird, that's for sure.
They're really noisy in the morning, especially if you walk through the park with your dog. They get all excited.
That sort of thing. I enjoy hearing it, so I'm not that bothered.
Charles, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. This was interesting. There aren't a lot of people that understand how these QSL managers work. At least I didn't. And I'm assuming that if you're new to DXing or you're new to chasing islands on the air or something like that, that understanding that there are people out there that do what you do is important to getting the confirmations, but also maybe even getting the cards.
Yeah. And of course, the thing we didn't touch on is that we do it for free. It's not a paid thing. We don't ask for money. We don't get money. If they make a donation, that's fine. But it's not a service that we ask for payment for. We all do it because we enjoy it. And I guess that's the same for every manager.
That's true for anybody that's making anything for amateur radio or for whatever other hobby they're supporting, right? You do it for the love of it.
You do. You do, absolutely, yeah. And as I say, I guess that's the same for any manager around the world. They'd all do it for free. It's just for the enjoyment and putting something back into the hobby, as we say. Yeah.
Right. Thank you so much. 73, Charles. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Eric. 73, and enjoy. Nice to hear you. Bye-bye.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Charles. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put an M0OXO in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, push the Sponsor Transcription button in the center of every show notes page. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing the subscribe buttons on the show notes pages. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. If listener sponsorship is not for you, then please use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on everything you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast, and it costs you nothing. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform by using Podcast Index. Use the latest Podcast 2.0 player on your smartphone to automatically get to your podcast updates as soon as we publish. I'm now using Podverse to track, manage, and listen to my podcasts. Positive comments about QSO Today on social media is appreciated as it helps to grow our listener base. My thanks to Ben Bresky, who makes this podcaster and guests sound brilliant. Thanks, Ben. Until next time, this is Eric for Z1UG 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.